Good morning. Always a delight to come back here. I'm going to begin with something which is entirely not a novel insight and has been said many times before, but it bears saying again. And that is, those parts of Tanakh that we are most familiar with from our early childhood are the parts of the Tanakh that we have the hardest time approaching again with adult eyes and seeing afresh. We have so ingrained in us the Midrashim of Chazal and the stories that we heard from our wonderful preschool teachers that we have a hard time putting those aside and re-engaging with Pesukim on their own terms. And so what I'd like to, and you know, of course, the great example of this is my daughter who comes home from nursery school, from kindergarten, this Shabbos with her Shabbos project to show us for Parashas Vayera. And the Shabbos project is a very cleverly constructed cup within a cup. And so you fill the inside cup with red Powerade and the outside cup with water, and you put a straw in each, and you have a demonstration of how it is that the Mitzrim drank blood from the cup while the Jews drank water from the cup. And my daughter had a great time with it, running around with her straws and her Powerade. But as we'll see, although that is a very well-known Agada of Chazal, it is not clear to all the Mepharshim that, in fact, the Mitzrim drank blood and the Jews drank water. So we're going to try today to look at the psukim related to the Makos and to think about the Makos both more globally but also with a sort of more direct engagement with the words of the psukim themselves. So we all know the Makos. We all know the 10 Makos. Again, we've been reciting them since we were in preschool. What was the purpose of these Makos? What was the purpose of this particular constellation of punishments? What was the purpose of this particular order? Why did they happen the way they do? Why are they grouped this way? And various different Mepharshim and commentators approach the Pesukim differently and try to give us different understandings of why it is that we get these Makos in this way. And we're going to look at a few different approaches today to understanding either, again, why these Makos or why this order or why these particular groupings, to get some understanding as to why it was that this set of punishments was visited upon Mitzrayim. And having said that we're going to move away from the Midrashic interpretation of the Makos, the first thing we'll do is look at some of the classic Midrashic interpretations as to why these Makos and why in this particular order. So Medrash Tanhuma offers us two explanations as to why this particular set of Makos. The first explanation that Medrash Tanhuma gives to us is that when a province rebels against the king and the king has to go bring the recalcitrant province back under his dominion, there's a certain order in which he takes action. And so the first thing he does is he besieges the city and cuts off its water supply. And so that would be analogous to the Makah of Dom, ensuring that they don't have fresh water to drink. And then the Midrash proceeds through each of the 10 Makos, explaining to us how each of the 10 relates to this progression. So, for example, the kinim, or you know, biting you and making you itch, are analogous to arrows being fired into the city. And then the wild animals that come into the city are like sending your armies against the city. And then, very interestingly, the shchin, the Medrash says, you know, we all have these pictures of like a medieval siege, and someone's at the top of the castle with a big pot of boiling oil to pour down on the besiegers. Well, that's what the Medrash says the Shchin is like firing some sort of burning substance into the city to make the people burn, and that's followed by Barak, which is now the cannonballs of some sort, and then Arba, the vast swarms of locusts, are like reinforcements and even more soldiers. And then finally Choshech, which Vayamesh Choshech, and they couldn't move. So that's like imprisoning the people responsible for the rebellion. And finally, the final step, if none of this has brought them to heel yet, would be executing the leaders of the rebellion, Makas Bechoros. And so Medrash Tanhuma offers that explanation, and the logic of the progression there is a sort of intensification of the efforts to bring a rebellious province or city to heel. The Medrash then offers another explanation as to why these particular punishments. And that second explanation as to why these particular punishments is that these punishments come mida keneged mida as direct retribution for the actions that the Mitzrim took against the Jews. And so for every one of the Makos, there was a particular tactic of enslavement or mode of torture or something that the Mitzrim did to the Jews, and therefore they're being punished in this way. So So, for example, they ordered the Jews to fetch and carry their water, and therefore they are now flooded with the Makkah of Dam, and they have no fresh water. Or they ordered the Jews to care for their children, and so now along comes the Makkah of Arov, and wild animals come and pick off their children. The Medrash has this description of a Jewish man being sent out with 10 Egyptian children in his care, and coming home with none, and being asked by his master what happened to all the kids, and saying, well, a lion came and took one, and a bear came and took another one, and a snake came and took a third one, and going down the list, and by the time you're done, well, that was where all the kids went. And so, for example, the animals died was because they asked the Jews, or they forced the Jews, to care for their animals, to shepherd their animals. Shechem, they had vile boils all over their body because they forced the Jews to bathe them. Barad, because they stoned the Jews. Arba, because they forced the Jews to tend their vineyards and their fields, so now all their produce is being destroyed. Choshech, because they imprisoned the Jews. And Makas Bechoros, because they killed the Jews. So the second explanation the Medrash gives us relates every one of the punishments of the Makos to a particular action that the Mitzrim took against the Jews. The Abar Vanel, then Isaac Abar Vanel, who was a fascinating figure in Jewish history anyway. I think we're sort of familiar with the contours of his story. He lives in Spain in the late 15th century, in the time of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. He's a high officer in their court. When they expel all the Jews, they offer him a chance to stay, because, you know, everybody has someone who's their best friend who's Jewish. So Ferdinand and Isabella also had a good friend who's Jewish, and they were willing to let him stay. And the Abar Vanel says, no, he casts his lot with his fellow Jews, and he leaves. But aside from his role as a courtier in the royal courts of Europe, he was also a commentator on Chumash. And the Abar Vanel approaches this with a very, very different approach, and one that I want to spend some time on because it's very interesting. The Abar Vanel says, if you do nothing more than very, very carefully and closely read the Pesukim, you see a very different kind of logic in this particular set of punishments and this particular order and these groupings. And the Abar Vanel says that logic emerges from the first encounter between Moshe and Aaron. So look at your source sheet. Very first source we have, Moshe Aaron. Hey, is that first encounter. Moshe and Aaron go to Paro, and they say, here's what God said. Let my people go that they shall serve me in the desert. And Paro's response is, Mi Hashem, Asher Eshma Bekolo, L'shaleach Es Yisrael, Lo Yadati Es Hashem, V'gam Es Yisrael Lo Ashaleach. Who is God that I should listen to him to send the Jews out? I don't know any God. And furthermore, I'm not sending the Jews out. The Abar Vanel says this response of Paro's consists of three separate challenges to God. First one is, I don't know who God is, I never heard of him. I don't believe there is one. Okay? Denial of the existence of God is the first challenge. The second one is, Asher Shema B'Kolo. Why do I have to listen to him? I don't believe, even if there is a God, even if he exists somewhere out there in the heavens, I don't believe that God is actually engaged in an ongoing way in the affairs of the world, so that I have to listen to what he says. Okay? And then the final challenge is, Gam Es Yisrael Lo Ashaleach. I'm not sending the Jews out, and God can't make me. So I don't know who God is. Even if God exists, I don't know that I believe that he commands my day-to-day doings, that he can tell me to send the Jews out and I have to listen to him. And even if he thinks he can command me what to do, he can't make me. So those are our three challenges. And the Abar Vanel says if we very carefully read the words of the Pesukim relating to the Makos, we see how the Makos come in three groupings, intended to address each of those three challenges, intended to respond to each of those three challenges. And the three groupings, of course, are the three groupings that we're already familiar with from the Haggadah, Rabbi Yehuda Hayanav Sehem Simanim, Tetzah Hadash Va'akam. And the point has been made many, many times in many different ways by many different commentators, that is not just a random mnemonic for remembering the Makos in order, but there is significance to breaking down the Makos in this way, and various different commentators understand what the significance is differently, and the Abar Vanel here is going to show us what he thinks the significance of that grouping of the Tzach, Adash, and Achav is. Okay? So, the first Makah, source number two, of course the Makah of Dam. And Hashem says, Hashem sends Moshe and Aharon to go to Paro at the Or in the morning. And Pasuk Tesayim, Ve'amarta elav Hashem Elokei ha'ivrim shlachani elecha le'mar shalach sami ve'amukim ba'midbar. So again, you don't know who God is, you don't know that God exists. I'm telling you, the God of the Hebrews has sent me to you, and he's telling you to let the Jews go. And if you don't do it, of course, everything is going to turn to blood. Needless to say, Pharaoh is not impressed. Pharaoh doesn't let the Jews go, and everything turns to blood. And again, the second Makkah, Hashem sends Moshe to Pharaoh. Thus says Hashem, send my people free and let them worship me, and if you don't, I'm going to smite your borders with Tzvar the Imar, which is another interesting discussion. Not everybody thinks that they are frogs. And again, Pharaoh doesn't listen. And finally, with the third Makkah, and each set of Makkahs, the third Makkah comes without a warning. And after the third Makkah of Kinim, when the Chartumim, when the magicians and the wizards of Pharaoh are unable to recreate the Makkah, their response is Etzba Elokim. They acknowledge that God exists and is active here. So the first set of Makkos is a response to Pharaoh's question, who's God and where is God? And the answer is, God is the one who's telling you to let the people go and he's going to bring his punishments upon you. And at the end of that first trio of Makkos, we have the Chartumim recognizing, indeed, this is the work of God. Okay, so the first question, Mi Hashem, who's God? The answer is, this is God. And eventually the Chartumim come to recognize it. Needless to say, Pharaoh doesn't let the Jews go, otherwise our story would end here, and of course it doesn't. And so we go on. And again, the first one of every three will begin to Moshe being sent to Pharaoh early in the morning at the riverside. And he goes to Pharaoh. And this time he says to him something interesting. He says, let my people go, don't worship me. Because if you don't let my people go, I'm going to send Arov, I'm going to send wild animals. And then look at Pasuk Ches. V'hiflesi bayom ha'hu et Eretz Goshen, asher ami omid oleha, v'vilti heyus shav Arov, l'ma'am tega, ki ani Hashem v'kerev ha'aretz. V'samti v'dos bein ami u'bein amecha, l'machar yihyeha o'sezeh. So this is the first time in the Pesukim that we have a mention of a distinction between the Jews and the Egyptians. The Pasuk says there will be Arov among the Egyptians, and there will be this assortment of wild animals among the Egyptians. There will not be Arov among the Jews. I'm going to make a distinction between my people and your people in order that you know, because I am God in the midst of the land. So Pharaoh's first challenge was, I don't know any God. And even if there is God, he's over there, you know, in the ether somewhere, he's not actively involved in what's going on in this world to tell me what I should do or I shouldn't do. Having established now in the first three Makkos that God exists, Hashem is now saying, I'd like to establish that I'm intimately involved in the activities going on in the world day to day, and I'm going to show this by sending wild animals on Mitzrayim, and the wild animals will afflict the Egyptians, and they will not afflict the Jews who are living side by side with them. And thus, following this logic, there are Mepharshim who suggest that in fact the first three Makkos affected the Jews as well. And that the distinction that the first three Makkos were kind of a general affliction on Mitzrayim, the water turned to blood and there were Tzardayim all over and there were lice all over. And again, this does not comport with the Midrashim that we learned as children. And certainly there are other Mepharshim who don't see it that way. They just see this as the first explicit statement that there will be a distinction. But there are Mepharshim who say that there was no distinction between Jews and Egyptians for the first three Makkos, that they were general plagues on the land, and they affected the Jews as well. But here we have a very clear statement of there will be a distinction made. The Abarbanel further says that if you look at Pasuk Yudches and then Yudtes, Yudches says, I will separate that day between Goshen, where my people are, and between Egypt. And then in the next Pasuk he says, I will make this distinction between my people and Rome. So the Abarbanel says, why do we need those two Pesukim if all they're telling us is there won't be Arov among the Jewish people? The first pasuk that says that says that. You don't need a second pasuk to say that. And the Abarbanel says that this is the first pasuk in class is a specific statement about this particular plague of Arov. And the second statement is a broader statement. And that's why we need the second statement there as well, about God distinguishing between the Jews and the Egyptians. So in this particular case, and in general, Hashem is saying, I distinguish between my people and the Egyptians in order that we may know that I am God in the midst of the land. So that's Aruv. If you look at the next Makkah, Dever, again, Hashem sends Moshe to Paro, let my people go. Ki ima'in atal shalayah lo'uchad ma'chazikba, ki ne'yad Hashem ho'ya v'miknecha asher v'sadeh, v'sifsib v'chamer v'mahim, all your animals, v'hitla Hashem v'miknei Yisrael v'miknei Mitzrayim v'lo yomus mikol v'mnei Yisrael davar. So again, the Pasuk now explicitly states, Hashem is telling Moshe to say this to Paro. God will distinguish between the animals of the Jews and the animals of the Egyptians, and when pestilence strikes the animals of the Egyptians, the animals of the Jews will be spared. And again, a statement of God's direct involvement in the affairs of this world, not simply some Aristotelian prime mover who's out there, but is not at all engaged on some kind of world. I know that's anachronistic. Paro didn't know anything about Aristotle. Okay, most of it was Aristotle, I believe. And Shechem, again, there's no warning, because the third one in each group, there's no warning, and they are commanded to take this Piach HaKivshan and throw it up, and everybody's going to get Shechem, and that is the third in this group. And so the purpose of this group, this second group, is to respond to Paro's question, or Paro's challenge, really more than a question, which is, even if God exists, God is not involved in the affairs of the world, and therefore, we can't really tell them to the Jews. And finally, the third challenge of Paro's was, even if God exists, and even if God is involved in the affairs of the world, wants something to do with the Jews. He can't make me. He simply does not have the power to force me to do what he wants to do. So he's a God. I'm a God, right? Paro is God. Nile is God. All kinds of things are God. So God is God, too. And he says stuff, and I say stuff, but he can't make me. And the last set of Makos, says the Rav Nel, again, just carefully read the words of the Pesukim, is devoted to establishing the limitlessness of God's power and the fact that he, in fact, can make power do what it is that he wants him to do. So we have finished with Shechem, and now we're up to source number 8. Again, wake up early in the morning and go to Paro, because the first of every group of three starts with an early morning conversation and walk the water. Again, God says, let my people go. If you don't, I will send all my plagues upon you. And he goes on to say, okay. If you look at Pasuk Dalet, the end of section 8, by Yibarad Va'ishus Latakas Vesot HaBarad, Kaveh Ma'od, Asher Lo Hayyak HaMohu B'chol Eretz Yisrayim, Me'oz Ha'isel Gun. So the intensification that we are hearing here, the new thing that we are hearing here, is that this Makkah is worse, this particular hailstorm or manifestation of hail is worse than any other type of hail that was ever seen before in Mitzrayim from the time it became a nation. And what's the purpose of that? The purpose of that is to show that God has the ultimate power. And if you challenge God's power, you will find yourself confronted not just with the hailstorm like any other hailstorm, but with the bar like no bar that you've ever seen before. And again, with Arabic, look at source number 9. Moshe and Aaron go, they warn Paro, there will be Arabic. Lots and lots of Arabic. If you look at Pasuk Vav, Umalu batecha batekol abadecha batekol Mitzrayim asher lo ra'u avosecha v'avos avosecha miyom v'yosam ala adama ad hayom hazeh. They will fill your houses and the houses of your servants and the houses of all Egypt, a plague of locusts such has never been seen before in Egypt. And again, the third set of Makos, the point of the third set of Makos is to respond to that challenge, God can't make me, even if there is such a God, even if he wants to tell me what to do, his power is limited. And the response is, his power is limitless. In all these plagues that he brings upon you, you will see plagues that are unlike any other such plagues that have ever been seen. And so we will have a very clear demonstration for Paro that in fact God's power is not limited in any way, and he very well can in fact compel Paro to do what it is that he wants to do. And then, of course, Choshech which comes without a warning, because it's the third one in every set of three. It comes without a warning, and they have this darkness that's so profound that the pasuk says nobody was able to move for 3 days. And then the final makkah, makkah's bechoros, source number 11, pasuk above. And in predicting makkah's bechoros, Moshe says, well, Hashem tells Moshe Paharo, "V'haistatz akagut olah b'chol eretz Yisrael, asher kamohu lo nidiyasa, v'chamohu lo sosif." There will be a great crying out in Yisrael of a sort that there has never been, and there will never be again. Again, this plague will be unlike anything else that has ever been seen before, as a manifestation of God's power. And of course, we know that when in fact that happens, Paro goes to Moshe and Aaron, and he says, last verse, took him on an olive on the base. Get up, get out, go worship God, do whatever you want, take anything you want, just go, go, go. So the Abarbanel's approach to understanding the Makos, based looking very carefully at the Psukim, is that Paro starts off by challenging Hashem in three ways. I don't know that God exists. If God exists, I don't believe he's involved in the day-to-day affairs of the world. And if he's involved in the day-to-day affairs of the world, he doesn't have any particular power over me. And the response group by group is to first demonstrate the existence of God, and then to demonstrate God's hashgacha, God's involvement in the day-to-day affairs of the world, and then finally, to demonstrate God's absence. So that is what the Abarbanel says the purpose of the Makos is. The purpose of the Makos is to respond to these three challenges. A much more recent, much more contemporary commentator, Rav Yaakovson, in Sefer Bina Bamikra, raises a very interesting question about the Makos. He says, the Pasuk says very clearly, Hashem, in describing what he's going to do to Mitzrayim, Rav Yaakovson in Bina Bamikra, says, the Pasuk says, V'chol Elohei Mitzrayim e'esesh batim. Among all the gods of Egypt, Hashem says he's going to do judgment. And we say this also in Haggadah. We talk about Hashem's disproving the power of the gods of Egypt. And so you have an obvious question, because in Pesukim we don't see any place where God does anything to take on the gods of Egypt. There are midrashim about it. Again, there are midrashim about how at midnight on the night of Makkah's Bechoros, as the Bechoros were dying, all the idols were toppled, or whatever it is. But there's no place in Pesukim directly where explains how these Makos in any way take on the gods of Egypt. And Rav Yaakovson, actually, based on the work of some scholars who had done some work in understanding the practices and beliefs of ancient Egypt, says that in fact, if we look at the Makos closely, we see that any number of the Makos respond to the religious beliefs and the both literal, as we'll see, and figurative sacred cows of ancient Egypt, and take them on. And even if the Pesukim doesn't say that that's what's happening, if you're familiar with something about the religious beliefs of ancient Egypt, you can see where these Makos are, well, as we would say, slugging them up. So the first example I think the one more familiar with is the Nile River as a deity in ancient Egypt. The Nile River was a source of all life. It flooded until the 1950s when they built the Aswan High Dam, and they stopped from flooding, but it used to flood and deposit silt. Water, and that was how Egypt was fertile, and could grow things. And we know that the Nile was venerated and worshipped, and of course, having the whole river turn to blood and stink and all the fish in it die is a rather good way of demonstrating that the Nile is not the source of life. It is not the source of whatever good things you see it is the source of. It is now the source of dead stinky fish and blood. Furthermore, Sister Yaakov said, not only was the Nile itself a god, but Paro associated himself with the Nile and derived his own divinity from it. So somehow Paro was the son or the offspring emerging from the Nile. We actually see this in the Haftarah that we just read for Parashat Vayera, which comes from Yechezkel. And Yechezkel there is speaking in the voice of a pharaoh, and the pharaoh is referred to as Hatanim HaGadol HaRobeit V'Silchiro, the great crocodile basking in his Nile, who says, Li ye'ori ba'ami asisimi. Mine is the Nile, and I have made it. So the pharaohs were associated, again, as sons, as, you know, somehow offspring of the Nile. And so by starting off every set of Makos by going to Paro early in the morning when he was going down to the river that itself was a god and was the source of his divinity and his power, to confront him there, to stand there and say to him, send my people forth and let them worship me, and Paro denying, and Paro refusing and of course being punished, Rabbi Jacobson says is the first direct sort of confrontation with the divinity of Egypt. He further points out, very interesting, if you go back to source number one, Hashem doesn't just say, send my people out to worship me. He says, Shalach asami v'yachoguli b'amidbar. Send my people out, and they will worship me, they will make a holiday for me, in the desert. So God is saying, you, in your beliefs about the divine, believe there are all kinds of different powers, each one of whom is limited to one area. So the Nile is, you know, fertility and life and everything else associated with being water. I don't have to be in a particular place, in a particular source of water, in order to be God. I'm God in the desert, too, where there's nothing, where it's dry and where it's barren. Hashem is saying to Paro, I still have, you know, I still have God there, because my power is not limited to one particular natural object, or one particular manifestation, or one particular type of power. You know, I'm God of this, and I'm God of that, and I'm God of the other. I'm God, so I'm God everywhere. I'm God in the desert as well, and therefore send my people out to worship me in the desert, in this dry and barren place, is a contrast to the Egyptian belief about the divinity containing the source of water. So that, says Rav Jacobson, is as far as the Nile. As far as the Im, Rav Jacobson says that the Egyptian goddess of fertility, the body of a woman, and the head of a frog, because frogs reproduce a whole lot, I guess. And that, in fact, he says the hieroglyph symbol for the number 100,000 is a frog, because, again, frogs represented great abundance and great fertility. And apparently Egyptian midwives used to wear amulets with a picture of a frog on them. Because, well, the picture of this goddess, the body of the woman and the head of the frog, because, again, it was a symbol of fertility, and it was supposed to help women in their labor travails. So the idea of the frog, or the frog-headed goddess, as a patron saint of fertility and women giving birth. And of course, this maka is making a mockery of all that. Because you have frogs coming out of the water, and they are being exceedingly fertile. They are just reproducing all over Mitzrayim, and you know, right? You can't get the frogs out of your house and your oven and your everything else. And so again, says Rabbi Jacobson, the second maka is making a mockery or debunking the Egyptian goddess of fertility, this woman. And finally, Rabbi Jacobson makes a very interesting point about the Chartumim in general, which relates to Kenim and relates to Shlim as well. And that is Kenim, lice, and apparently to Shlim, and relates as well to Shlim and boils. So the Egyptian priests, one of the identifying characteristics of the Egyptian priesthood was apparently a fanatical obsession with personal physical cleanliness. They're living in a sandy, dusty country, as was the case in much of the ancient and early modern world. Lice were widespread, probably pretty much universal. And the ancient Egyptian priests, part of what identified them as being special or different was that they were much cleaner than their average Egyptian. And, for example, they shaved their heads and all of their body hair to ensure that they would not have lice. So that everybody else in Egypt was walking around with, you know, general state of ancient world, which is, you know, having little buddies on them, and the Egyptian priests are completely shaven and have no lice, and the sacred bulls of the Egyptian religion also were guarded very carefully to make sure that they were completely insect and bug free. And when the Mach of Kenim comes, and it's very clear from the words of the Psukim that the Mach of Kenim afflicts everyone and everything in Mitzrayim, it afflicts the Egyptian priests as well. So part of their religious worship has been to make sure that they are completely clean and louse-free, and now here they are afflicted by lice, and their response to God, of course, is to say, as fellow kin, we recognize that this is the action of God, because this has been part of our religious worship, to make sure that we keep ourselves spotlessly and insect-free, and here we are confessing. My mother insisted that I say this, so in my mother's name I say this. When Cecil B. DeMille picked Yul Brynner to play Pharaoh in his Ten Commandments, My mother insists that it was an act of historical verisimilitude that they picked this man who was bold to represent Pharaoh. I said, Cecil B. DeMille did not know anything about pharaohs being bold. My mother said, absolutely, yes, he did. He had people who did historical research for him, and he knew that Pharaoh was supposed to be bold. So if you choose that, I suppose, charitable interpretation of Cecil B. DeMille's historical knowledge, that's why Yul Brynner got the role of Pharaoh, because he was bold, and priests in ancient Egypt and pharaohs and other high people have been bold. So there you have it. But again, by Shchin, very interestingly, which is another plague that affects, that afflicts the body, and afflicts the body in a kind of gruesome sort of way. The Pasuk tells us, we're back in source number 7, Pasuk Yud Aleph. The Pasuk specifically tells us, V'lo yachlu ha-chartumim la'amud v'nei Moshe v'nei ha-shchin, ki haya ha-shchin b'chartumim u'b'chol Mitzrayim. That the Chartumim could not stand up in front of Moshe because they were covered with these boils and blisters, which afflicted them as well as the rest of Egypt. Now, if the boils and blisters afflicted all of Egypt, what do we have to know? That the wizards or the magic makers were particularly afflicted by Shchin. But the answer would be, again, that the priests of ancient Egypt would have made significant efforts to keep themselves clean and free of such afflictions, and the fact, therefore, that they were afflicted was more than just the physical ailment that it was for everybody else. It was a great shame or a great psychic blow that they were not able to maintain their status as the clean and pure priests who engaged in worship in ancient Egypt. Okay, so let's take a few minutes to briefly wrap up, and then we'll conclude. So we started off by trying to look for a broader perspective as to what the purpose of the Makos was. And we said that purpose could be in this particular constellation of 10 plagues, why these plagues, or it could be something about the way they developed and unfolded in their order as to why it was that these Makos were brought as a punishment. We started off with two midrashim, one midrash that connects these to the tactics of war, when one wages war against a city and kind of intensification of efforts to bring the city back under the king against whom it is rebelling. We then went on to quote a second medrash, which relates each of these plagues as being a measure for measure punishment for something that the Egyptians did against the Jews. Therefore, they have to be punished in a similar way. We discussed the parish of Yavar Benel, who says that Paro began his defiance against God with a series of 3 challenges. I do not know about the existence of God, even if God exists. He is not Mashkiach, he does not supervise the day-to-day affairs of the world, and even if he does that, he cannot make me do what I don't want to do. And we said that the set of the first 3 Makos is intended to demonstrate, as you saw in the words of Pesukim, God's existence. The set of the second 3 Makos is intended to demonstrate God's involvement in the world and day-to-day activities, as made clear by the restatement that Hashem will separate between the Jews and the Egyptians, that the plague will only affect the Egyptians and not the Jews. And the third set of Makos, plus Makos Bechoros, is meant to demonstrate the absoluteness of God's power, as indicated by the repeated statements in the Pesukim that this plague was worse than any other such plague that had ever been seen. And of course, Paro finally lets the Jews go. And then we talked about Rabbi Yaakov and Yehuda Mikra, looking at various of the Makos as themselves as being manifestations of Hashem's rendering judgment on the gods of Egypt, whether it's on the Nile River itself, whether it's on the Egyptian goddess of fertility, or whether it's on the priests as the agents of various Egyptian divinities who were expected to maintain themselves in a state of cleanliness. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Well, we start to get a little bit, you know, further into Makos.
The question is there any indication after the second set that Paro starts to realize that God is involved? After the first set, and the second set, is there any indication that Paro recognizes God is involved? In fact, we start to get it. Paro say, hey, fine, you can let him go, right? You know, we're all just stop it, let him go, and then he stops and kind of get the hardening of Paro's heart, which is itself interesting. Whole other very complicated discussions of what means such important part of Paro. But yes, you do get these acknowledgments in extremis, in the moment of the Maka, in which Paro says, only one let the people go, but then once the Maka is lifted, there's the heart hardening and the fact that they don't. Yes? Yes. Yes. There is, in fact, a discussion of time frame in the Parsha. And some of these time frames, as you would imagine, if you just sort of think through it, some of these discussions of time frame give you actually a very long period in which the Malkus are taking place. It's not a three-day kind of, because you think about a warning period for the three Malkus, for every set of three Malkus. So for the first two, you would have a warning period. There's a certain amount of time for the warning, and then you have a period of time with the plague, and then a period of time, another warning. And if you kind of go through the math, it turns out that the Malkus are playing out over a period of months, which, you know, just makes sense if you think about it. You're talking about 10 Malkus and warning periods for each one, and then a certain duration of Malka, and then a certain amount of time before the next warning period happens. So yes, the Malkus are, which also then goes back to the question of, message is going on for your 10 months. And then, of course, we answer that with the Hashem part and part of his heart. And that's an interesting position. Yes? So that question would be according to the, and again, this is not the most, most mainstream approach that the first Malkus is affected the Jews, but nevertheless, it is an approach out there. And why would it be that the Jews were afflicted as well? I could think of a number of possible answers to that. One would be that the general demonstration of God's power would have been useful for the Jews as well, which would remember not exactly the most receptive people in the world, Moshe and Aaron show up to say, Hashem wants to take you out. They say, Moshe and Aaron, things about mercies became and really needs you. And of course, we do have a midrash that the majority of the Jewish people perished in the plague of darkness because they didn't believe in the coming Exodus and didn't merit redemption. And so it's been, this, of course, would have been the plague of darkness, which still had a large population of Jewish people who, were in that category. But even if you want to take that sort of specific point of view, I think the perhaps less I think would just have been the general demonstration of God's power was a demonstration of God's power for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, great. That's a great question. The great question is, are we looking at the Malkut as a punishment of the enemy, or is it an attempt to get them to see the light and come around to the proper understanding? And I'm going to have to keep the non-answer saying the answer is clearly both. If you look at source number 8, Pasuk Kesdayim, this is the beginning of the third group of the Malkus. Hashem is warning you about Bara. And he says in Kesdayim, again, talking to the Ulam Ba'avorzos Ha'emadadita Ba'avor Ha'osha Esporti L'man Saper Shemi B'chol Ha'aretz. This is why I have stood you up, meaning I sort of propped you up to enable you to continue withstanding these plagues so I can send you more of them, in order to show you my strength, that you may recount my name in the whole land. So again, there is clearly the purpose of the simple understanding of the Malkus is punishment. But there clearly also is the purpose of achieving a recognition and understanding of God, and God saying the reason why I have enabled you to withstand all these plagues and keep visiting more on you is that you eventually come to recognize me and you can, sort of share that recognition. And interestingly, there is a message that picks up on this particular angle that the purpose of the Malkus for Paro was to get him to hang in there until he eventually recognized God. There is a message that says that Paro can try and actually survives the Yamzuk, and that he's tossed up when everybody else drowns, and he ends up off to Nineveh and becoming the king of Nineveh, and that he's the king of Nineveh when Yonah shows up, and he gives the warning that, oh, Rabbi, you don't do Nineveh, don't do the Tshuva, Nineveh is going to be destroyed, and that Paro says to the people, really, I got to tell you, the prophets from the Jews come and warn you about things like this, it's best to take him seriously, been there, done that, bought the teacher, we don't want to do this again, and that's why Nineveh does Tshuva. Now, again, when we're understanding the message, the question of does that literally mean this particular person of power, surviving as a king, or does it mean that in some way that message transmitted itself, and therefore Nineveh, the city of Nineveh, is willing to do Tshuva, when they get the money. That's
in any case that slavery stops. Okay, so the portion actually we talk about that as well.
We don't, again, there's not necessarily only one answer to that. The message that I quoted to you earlier about Aro certainly makes it sound like as far along as Aro, the Jews are still enslaved. This is being sent off to the marketplace with 10 to 15 kids. By the time we get off to later on in the Machos, where the Jews are sent to ask their Egyptian neighbors for their gold, silver, and jewelry, that's really pretty much the end of the process. But it seems that at that point they're operating much more as equals. So again, that comes into the discussion of the time frame and exactly when it is that the intensity of the slavery abates. But as the Medrash points out, before they won't be going to the Machos, what's there to choose to do? Because then there are no animals to tend, and there are no fields to tend, really, there's much less, much less work for anybody to do. Okay, thank you very much.